Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, we bring you the second in a two-part conversation between Steve and Dr. Christopher Hand. You'll remember from last week that Chris is a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Glasgow in Scotland. This week, he talks with Steve about what companies are learning about productivity post-COVID and responding to cyber abuse in the workplace.
One of the challenges, I think, for a lot of employers is knowing which way to go. And traditionally, I think what we're seeing is this return to norms that we understand. So you mentioned productivity, particularly when it comes to things like that. You know, I might take a view that a certain group were more productive when they used to be in the office because we used to see more work being generated, more output, and perhaps the quality of it was greater. Others may take a very different view. And we're starting to see some of that coming through, aren't we, in terms of particularly in the financial services space where banks, insurance companies are coming out, some of them anyway, mostly American at the moment, making fairly strong statements about, you know, working from home doesn't work for us, that kind of thing. But the point that you make is that we simply don't have enough data. We don't have enough information. And so I suppose we are going to have to continue for a while to suck it and see. There isn't any other way of putting it, I suppose, and see what works best for our employees and what works best for our organisations. Is that where we're headed, do you think? Do we need more patience?
I think patience and also synthesis of multiple data types is very important. So depending on how we define success, we might choose to prioritise certain types of data over others. But I think having multiple stakeholders involved in the conversation is very helpful and having multiple types of data. So, you know, someone might take a very cynical approach and simply look at either revenue or profit, but that has to be factored against other things like staff turnover, staff satisfaction, client satisfaction. You know, it depends on the type of business or organisation or industry. So I think taking a kind of multiple methods approach and drawing on multiple data sources and trying to synthesise them is the way to go. But depending on where in the world you are, we've had lesser or greater periods of time away from the stricter parts of the COVID restrictions. So whether or not we've had long enough and whether or not we've been able to obtain enough data from multiple sources to really draw informed conclusions is very difficult. And people's circumstances shift as well. You know, what might be right for a person in 1 year might not be right the next, particularly for people who have caring responsibilities and changeable caring responsibilities. And even, for example, you know, a parent of a child who goes to preschool, their needs will change when that child goes into school because of different timetabling and maybe different locations, etc. So, you know, continually engaging with people at a fairly intimate level is very important in understanding how we tailor support and how we achieve, you know, success for as many people as possible.
I think one of the things that's coming across loud and clear, Chris, in talking to you, is that we simply don't know at the moment enough about this whole situation, about the way that we're evolving, whether it be in where we work, how we work, but certainly in terms of online human behavior. And that presumably is something that over time we'll get better at. And potentially, anyway, could very much change the way in which we view the whole online relationship, whether that be personal or whether that be at a business level.
Again, this is one of the things that makes it so fascinating to me, is that it is changing. And not to make everything about the pandemic, because it's not all about the pandemic, but the pandemic has in many ways amplified and accelerated a lot of these questions and issues. We've seen rapid change. We've seen digital pivots in organisations that had maybe been a bit slow to try and make digital transitions. So, for example, higher education. And to take the higher education context as one specific example, people have pretty ingrained ideas about what higher education should look like. And trying to change those perceptions is very difficult and it takes time. And trying to communicate the benefits of maybe hybrid models or online models is very difficult because people have such entrenched views about what it should be. And it's the same in the workplace. It's the same in other workplaces. You know, people have an idea, a schema or a heuristic about what that should be, and then presenting something that looks rather different can be very challenging. It can be very difficult for people to appreciate the possible benefits of that. And in terms of the kind of human behaviour side of it and the online behaviour side of it, again, there's still so many questions that need to be answered. You know, there was some interesting recent research about trustworthiness and competence simply based on someone's video conferencing background. And these sort of cues are quite subtle, but potentially quite important. So, you know, we need to start thinking about how we train people to present online and how to behave online, particularly in an occupational context. You know, we've spent a lot of time concentrating on how people behave in social spaces online, what is and what is not acceptable, what is and what is not safe. But I think there needs to be a great emphasis from quite an early age about how people present online, how people communicate online in a professional way, not just in a social or a romantic way.
And that takes me on to one other area that I did want to talk to you about, which is that of cyberbullying, where we've seen, you know, a bit of an increase most recently. And you make the point there that we need to educate people better so that they understand effectively how they're coming across, because some elements of cyberbullying may be completely by chance. You simply don't realize that what you're doing is having the kind of effect that it might have on somebody else. Some of it, of course, is very much more insidious than that and is clearly intended to bully. So tell us a little bit about this whole sort of concept of cyberbullying and where are we with that?
Unfortunately, cyberbullying has kind of been around since the beginning of digital communication. Now, whether it comes through mobile devices and things like SMS, WhatsApp, instant messaging, or whether it's more public facing, making use of profiles on social media sites, visible or blogs. Where we are is that we understand that it's tremendously upsetting for the people who are victimized. We understand that often the perpetrators don't face consequences. And we understand that in some cases the law is lagging behind the technology and the reality. So there are a lot of parallels between the consequences of cyberbullying and the consequences of intimate human interaction bullying. We know that the reasons people perpetrate are very similar. But what we are struggling to understand, or what we know less about, are the kind of ancillary consequences in terms of reputation, in terms of perception of the victim and perception of the perpetrators. So in the digital space, cyber abuse and cyber bullying are a little bit different from real world bullying in that the incidents themselves have a much wider audience. They're much more public and in some ways they're more permanent because there's a digital record that could either be screenshotted and shared or disseminated by other means. So from that respect, there are a lot of parallels between kind of traditional bullying and cyberbullying and traditional abuse and cyber abuse. And one of the things that's a big challenge, particularly for employers, is where is the line between the personal space and the professional space? So increasingly, people have to use social media and use a web presence as part of their professional development or in terms of their professional identity. And it becomes somewhat difficult to then delineate their conduct, unless, of course, they're using separate accounts, in which case there's maybe a clearer borderline between what someone has done as a personal, private person or as a, you know, as a person in the professional domain. We know that a lot of cyber abuse and cyberbullying involves people who are connected in real life. That could be colleagues, it could be employer-employee. And again, we know that people are often quite sophisticated in how they set up their digital profiles or their social media spaces so that they can kind of commit these acts of cyber abuse and cyber bullying behind the person's virtual back. And again, whether or not we understand well enough the opportunities for people to whistleblow, the opportunities for people to intervene, the opportunities for people to be traumatized by looking at the abuse of others, these are still questions that we need to know more about. But certainly, it's a problem that does seem to be growing. It seems to be an issue that increasingly is used in a weaponized way, particularly along the lines of sex and gender and race. And we see increasingly sophisticated use of coordination, either amongst real people or amongst real people using artificial intelligence to essentially campaign against either individuals or organisations. And the consequences of this can be incredibly serious. There are all too many stories of people choosing to end their own lives because of this. And we've seen quite drastic financial consequences for organisations when people have decided to troll them or abuse them or instigate a campaign of coordinated abuse based on either a real event or indeed something that has been fictionalised.
And of course, you made the point earlier that once something is out there in the digital world, it's exceptionally difficult to take it down and to remove it. So what are some top tips in terms of how people might deal with cyberbullying if they feel that they're a victim of it or if they see it happening?
Again, this can be quite challenging depending on where and how someone was raised. You know, people are often reluctant to be the grass, but ultimately telling and reporting what has been seen or what has happened is very important. And that can either be to a platform owner in the case of social media, or to a line manager, or to a colleague or someone you trust. So reporting is very important. People generally have a sense for what is right and what is not right. And even in the case of possible ambiguity, I think it's still better to flag something up than not. And again, making sure that people have a safe way to do that is really important. So if it doesn't feel right, if it doesn't look right, the chances are you should probably talk to someone about it. Challenge behaviour that you think is unacceptable. And again, unfortunately, people don't often feel that they know how to do this. You know, people don't often feel that they know how to report a tweet, for example, or they're not sure about whether a crime has been committed, or they're not sure what the underlying relationship between the two interactees might actually be. So it's easy to say, you know, report things, flag things up, ask for help. But again, people might not feel safe to do that. And indeed, they might not feel that they have the competence to do it. And also at an organisational level, there has to be someone who is trained in order to deal with the complaints or the reports. So do we have enough of that skill and knowledge within our organisation so that when someone raises a concern, it can be dealt with? That's for individual organisations to appraise. But certainly the only way that we're going to challenge it in a meaningful way is when there are consequences for people who behave inappropriately online. And also, the only way we're really going to get on top of that is when we have effective reporting mechanisms. And unfortunately, there are high profile cases where people have behaved abhorrently, and yet there seems to be no meaningful consequence to them, either in terms of their reputation or in terms of their success, depending on how you want to define success, or indeed based on their access to platforms. If we're really serious about, you know, making positive change, certain high-profile individuals should be deplatformed, and, you know, not deplatformed based on political ideology or anything like that, but based on basic humanity, you know, based on the basic principles of human decency. There are some individuals that should not have the platform and the voice that they have because they use it poorly and they use it in a way that can destroy people's lives.
And no doubt some of the social media platforms who might be listening to this would probably counter that by saying they provide the environment. They don't necessarily police the environment. Do you have any sympathy with that position?
Yes, in short, I do. Because again, the problem isn't the tool. The problem is how the tool is used. You know, I think there can be modifications to the tool to maybe make it safer or maybe make it easier to report malfeasance. But again, a lot of this comes back to the human being that operates the tool. If the human being lacks decency and lacks empathy and compassion, or completely lacks the self-awareness, then there needs to be consequences. And there are some people, unfortunately, who just can't be trained to behave better. And unfortunately, we know that there are a large number of individuals out and about who take pleasure from, you know, at best winding someone up, at worst deliberately hurting someone. And understanding how we identify those individuals is important, because again, we know that there is often a very strong relationship between the type of people who do that type of thing online and the type of person who does that in the real world. So from a psychological perspective, I think negative online behavior is worrying, not just because for the effects on the people who receive it online, but for what that person might be capable of doing in the real world and indeed possibly does in the real world. So there's a huge amount of positives that can come from social networking. There's a huge amount of positivity that can come from existing in the digital world. You know, there are many people who have built successful careers purely on the back of their online presence. There are, you know, countless examples of how technology has been used for good. And I think it's really important that we don't fall into the trap of blaming the hosts, blaming the platforms entirely, because they do provide a really valuable tool. There's a lot of people who rely on those platforms for their social interaction, you know, for reasons maybe of disability or reasons of isolation that they can't interact with people in the real world. And digital platforms give people that connection that they might otherwise be missing out on. So I certainly would like to come across that I'm trying to say we should do away with social media or we should scrap the platforms. Absolutely not. You know, they've transformed the way we live. And generally speaking, I think they've transformed it for the better. I think we do need to understand, though, that there need to be ways to better and more effectively quash negative presences. And it's very hard to change the human, but it might be easier to take their toy away.
And I think, Chris, what you've done over the course of the podcast is really highlight to people some of the, yes, benefits of technology, but also some of the pitfalls. And I'm sure people will have taken away some of the tips that you've given in terms of how to deal with some of those situations. So thank you very much indeed for sharing those insights. Been a really fascinating chat with you. And I'm sure that our listeners will also have benefited a great deal from hearing you talk about some of those different challenges and how to deal with them. So thank you very much indeed, Chris.
Our thanks to Dr. Chris Hand for sharing his insights with us over the past 2 weeks. We'll be back with a new episode next week. In the meantime, if you would take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening, give us a 5-star rating and write a quick review, we'd be grateful. You can also listen to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in-depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with senior producer Katie Flood. Mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Thanks for listening.